in the society of witnesses. In her case, at least, it never came to a sexual threat. The brothers and sisters around her were all mild-mannered, sincere people. They thought seriously about their faith, and they lived with reverence for their doctrines, to the point of staking their lives on them. But decent motives don't always produce decent results. And the body is not the only target of rape. Violence does not always take visible form, and not all wounds gush blood. Seeing Tsubasa reminded Amame of herself at that age. My own will made it possible for me to escape back then. But when you're as seriously wounded as this girl, it may not be possible to bring yourself back. You might never be able to return your heart to its normal condition again. The thought sent a stab of pain through Amame's chest. What she had discovered in Tsubasa was herself as she might have been. I have to confess something to you, the dowager said softly to Amame. I can tell you this now, but the fact is, though I knew it was a disrespectful thing to do, I ran a background check on you. The remark brought Amame back to the present. She looked at the dowager. It was right after the first time I invited you to the house and we talked. I hope you're not offended. No, not at all, Amame said. In your situation, it was a natural thing to do. The work we are engaged in is by no means ordinary. Exactly. We are walking a very delicate fine line. We have to be able to trust each other. No matter who the other person is, though, you can't have trust if you don't know what you need to know. So I had them look up everything about you, from the present all the way back into the past. I suppose I should say almost everything, of course. No one can know everything about another person. Not even God, probably. Or the devil, Amame said. Or the devil, the dowager repeated with a faint smile. I know that you carry cult-connected psychological scars from when you were a girl. Your parents were, and still are, ardent believers in the Society of Witnesses, and they have never forgiven you for abandoning the faith. That causes you pain even now. Al-Mamin nodded silently. To give you my honest opinion, the dowager went on, the Society of Witnesses is not a proper religion. If you had been badly injured or come down with an illness that required surgery, you might have lost your life then and there. Any religion that would prohibit life-saving surgery simply because it goes against the literal word of the Bible can be nothing other than a cult. This is an abusive dogma that crosses the line. Al-Mamin nodded. The rejection of blood transfusion is the first thing pounded into the heads of witness children. They are taught that it is far better to die and go to heaven with an immaculate body and soul than to receive a transfusion in violation of God's teaching and go to hell. There is no room for compromise. It's one road or the other. You go either to hell or to heaven. Children have no critical powers. They have no way of knowing whether such a doctrine is correct, either as an idea widely accepted by society or as a scientific concept. All they can do is believe what their parents teach them. If I had been caught in the position of needing a transfusion when I was little, I'm sure I would have followed my parents' orders and chosen to reject the transfusion and die. Then I supposedly would have been transported to heaven, or someplace who knows where. Is this culture talking about well-known? Amame asked. It's called Sakigake, I'm sure you've heard of it. At one point, it was being mentioned in the paper almost every day. Aomame could not recall having heard the name Sakigake, but rather than say so, she nodded vaguely to the dowager. She felt she had better just leave it at that, aware that she was no longer living in 1984, but in the changed world of 1Q84. That was still just a hypothesis, but one that was steadily increasing in reality with each passing day. There seemed to be a great deal of information in this new world, of which she knew nothing. She would have to pay closer attention. The dowager went on. Sakigake originally started out as a small agricultural commune run by a core New Left group who had fled from the city. But it suddenly changed direction at one point and turned into a religion. How and why this came about is not well understood. The dowager paused for breath and then continued speaking. Very few people know this, but the group has a guru they call leader. They view him as having special powers, which he supposedly uses to cure serious illnesses, to predict the future, to bring about paranormal phenomena, and such. They're all elaborate ruses, I'm sure, but they are another reason that many people are drawn to him. Paranormal phenomena? The dowager's beautifully shaped eyebrows drew together. I don't have any concrete information on what that is supposed to mean. I've never had the slightest interest in matters of the occult. People have been repeating the same kinds of fraud throughout the world since the beginning of time, using the same old tricks. And still, these despicable fakes continue to thrive. That is because most people believe not so much in truth as in things they wish were the truth. Their eyes may be wide open, but they don't see a thing. Tricking them is as easy as twisting a baby's arm. Sakigake. Aomame tried out the word. What did it mean, anyway? Forerunner? Precursor? Pioneer? It sounded more like the kind of name that would be attached to a Japanese super express train than to a religion. Tsubasa lowered her eyes momentarily when she heard the word Sakigake, as though reacting to a special sound concealed within it. When she raised her eyes again, her face was as expressionless as before, as if a small eddy had suddenly begun to swirl inside her and had immediately quieted down. Sakigake's guru is the one who raped Tsubasa, the dowager said. He took her by force on the pretext of granting her a spiritual awakening. The parents were informed that the ritual had to be completed before the girl experienced her first period. Only such an undefiled girl could be granted a pure spiritual awakening. The excruciating pain caused by the ritual would be an ordeal she would have to undergo in order to ascend to a higher spiritual level. The parents took them at his word with complete faith. It is truly astonishing how stupid people can be. Nor is Tsubasa's the only such case. According to our intelligence, the same thing has been done to other girls in the cult. The guru is a degenerate with perverted sexual tastes. There can be no doubt. The organization and the doctrines are nothing but a convenient guise for masking his individual desires. Does this guru have a name? Unfortunately, we haven't learned that yet. He's just called leader. We don't know what sort of person he is, what he looks like or anything about his background. No matter how much we dig, the information is not forthcoming. It has been totally blocked. He stays shut up in cult headquarters in the mountains of Yamanashi and almost never appears in public. Even inside the cult, the number of individuals allowed to see him is highly restricted. He is said to be always in the dark, meditating. And we can't allow him to continue unchecked. The dowager glanced at Tsubasa and nodded slowly. We can't let there be any more victims. Don't you agree? In other words, we have to take steps. The dowager reached over and laid her hand atop Tsubasa's, steeping herself in a moment of silence. Then she said, "Exactly." It is quite certain, then, that he repeatedly engages in these perverted acts? Amame asked. The dowager nodded. We have proof that he is systematically raping girls. If it's true, it's unforgivable, Amame said softly. You are right. We can't let there be any more victims. Several different thoughts seemed to be intertwined and competing for space in the dowager's mind. Then she said, we must learn a great deal more about this leader person. We must leave no ambiguities. After all, a human life hangs in the balance. This person almost never comes out in public, you say? Correct. And he probably has extremely tight security. Amame narrowed her eyes and pictured to herself the specially made ice pick in the back of her dresser drawer, the sharp point of its needle. This sounds like a very tough job. Yes, unusually difficult, the dowager said. She drew her hand back from Tsubasa's and pressed the tip of her middle finger against her eyebrow. This was a sign, not one she displayed very often, that the dowager had run out of ideas. Aomame said, realistically speaking, it would be next to impossible for me to go out to the Yamanashi Hills on my own, sneak into this heavily guarded cult, dispatch their leader, and come out unscathed. It might work in a ninja movie, but I am not expecting you to do any such thing, of course, the dowager said earnestly, before realizing that Aomame's last remark had been a joke. It is out of the question, she added with a wan smile. One other thing concerns me, Aomame said, looking into the dowager's eyes. The little people. Who or what are they? What do they do to Tsubasa? We need more information about them. Fingers still pressed against her brow, the dowager said. Yes, they concern me too. Tsubasa here hardly speaks at all, but the words little people have come out of her mouth a number of times, as you heard earlier. They probably mean a lot to her, but she won't tell us a thing about them. She clams up as soon as a topic arises. Give me a little more time. I'll look into this matter, too. Do you have some idea how we can learn more about Sakigake? The dowager gave her a gentle smile. There is nothing tangible in this world you can't buy if you pay enough. And I am prepared to pay a lot, especially where this matter is concerned. It may take a little while, but I will obtain the necessary information without fail. There are some things you can't buy no matter how much you pay, Aomame thought. For example, the moon. Aomame changed the subject. Are you really planning to raise Tsubasa yourself? Of course. I am quite serious about that. I intend to adopt her legally. I'm sure you are aware that the formalities will not be simple, especially given the situation. Yes, I am prepared for that, the dowager said. I will use every means at my disposal, do everything I can. I will not give her up to anyone. The dowager's voice trembled with emotion. This was the very first time she had displayed such feeling in Al-Mama's presence. Al-Mama found this somewhat worrisome, and the dowager seemed to read this in her expression. I have never told this to anyone, the dowager said, lowering her voice as if preparing to reveal a long-hidden truth. I have kept it to myself because it was too painful to speak about. The fact is, when my daughter committed suicide, she was pregnant. 6 months pregnant. She probably did not want to give birth to the boy she was carrying, and so she took him with her when she ended her own life. If she had delivered the child, he would have been about the same age as Tsubasa here. I lost two precious lives at the same time. I'm sorry to hear that, Al-Mama said. Don't worry, though. I am not allowing such personal matters to cloud my judgment. I will not expose you to needless danger. You, too, are a precious daughter to me. We are already part of the same family. Al-Mama nodded silently. We have ties more important than blood, the dowager said softly. Al-Mama nodded again. Whatever it takes, we must liquidate that man, the dowager said, as if trying to convince herself. Then she looked at Al-Mama. At the earliest possible opportunity, we must move him to another world, before he injures someone else. Al-Mama looked across the table at Tsubasa. The girl's eyes had no focus. She was staring at nothing more than an imaginary point in space. To Al-Mama, the girl looked like an empty cicada shell. But at the same time, we mustn't rush things along, the dowager said. We have to be careful and patient. Al-Mama left the dowager and the girl Tsubasa behind in the apartment when she walked out of the safe house. The dowager had said she would stay with Tsubasa until the girl fell asleep. The four women in the first floor common room were gathered around a circular table, leaning in closely, engaged in a hushed conversation. To Al-Mama, the scene did not look real. The women seemed to be part of an imaginary painting, perhaps with the title, Women Sharing a Secret. The composition exhibited no change when Al-Mama passed by. Outside, Al-Mama knelt down to pet the German Shepherd for a while. The dog wagged her tail with happy abandon. Whenever she encountered a dog, Al-Mama would wonder how dogs could become so unconditionally happy. She had never once in her life had a pet, neither dog nor cat nor bird. She had never even bought herself a potted plant. Al-Mama suddenly remembered to look up at the sky, which was covered by a featureless gray layer of clouds that hinted at the coming of the rainy season. She could not see the moon. The night was quiet and windless. There was a hint of moonlight filtering through the overcast, but no way to tell how many moons were up there. Walking to the subway, Al-Mama kept thinking about the strangeness of the world. If, as the dowager had said, we are nothing but gene carriers, why do so many of us have to lead such strangely shaped lives? Wouldn't our genetic purpose, to transmit DNA, be served just as well if we lived simple lives, not bothering our heads with a lot of extraneous thoughts, devoted entirely to preserving life and procreating? Did it benefit the genes in any way for us to lead such intricately warped, even bizarre lives? A man who finds joy in raping prepubescent girls, a powerfully built gay bodyguard, people who choose death over transfusion, a woman who kills herself with sleeping pills while 6 months pregnant, a woman who kills problematic men with the needle thrust to the back of the neck, men who hate women, women who hate men. How could it possibly profit the genes to have such people existing in this world? Did the genes merely enjoy such deformed episodes as colorful entertainment? Or were these episodes utilized by them for some greater purpose? Al-Mameh didn't know the answers to these questions. All she knew was that it was too late to choose any other life for herself. All I can do is live the life I have. I can't trade it in for a new one. However strange and misshapen it might be, this is it for the gene carrier that is me. I hope the Dowager and Tsubasa will be happy, Al-Mameh thought as she walked along. If they can become truly happy, I don't mind sacrificing myself to make it happen. I myself probably have no future to speak of, but I can't honestly believe that the two of them are going to have tranquil, fulfilled lives, or even ordinary lives. The three of us are more or less the same. Each of us has borne too great a burden in the course of our lives. As the Dowager said, we are like a single family, but an extended family, engaged in an endless battle, united by deep wounds to the heart, each bearing some undefined absence. In the course of pursuing these thoughts, Al-Mameh became aware of her own intense urge for male flesh. Why, of all things, should I start wanting a man at a time like this? She shook her head as she walked along, unable to judge whether this increased sexual desire had been brought about by the psychological tension, or was the natural cry of the egg stored inside her, or just a product of her own genes' warped machinations. The desire seemed to have very deep roots, or, as Ayumi might say, I want to fuck like crazy. What should I do now? Al-Mameh wondered. I could go to one of my usual bars and look for the right kind of guy. It's just one subway stop to Roppongi. But she was too tired for that. Nor was she dressed for seduction. No makeup, only sneakers and a vinyl gym bag. Why don't I just go home, open a bottle of red wine, masturbate, and go to sleep? That's it. And let me stop thinking about the moon. One glance was all it took for Al-Mameh to realize that the man sitting across from her on the subway home from Hiro to Jiugaoka was her type. Mid-40s, oval face, hairline beginning to recede. Head shape not bad. Healthy complexion, slim, stylish, black-framed glasses, smartly dressed, light cotton sport coat, white polo shirt, leather briefcase on lap, brown loafers. A salaried working man, from the look of him, but not at some straight-laced corporation. Maybe an editor at a publishing company, or an architect at a small firm, or something to do with apparel, that was probably it. He was deeply absorbed in a paperback, its title obscured by a bookstore's plain wrapper. Al-Mameh thought she would like to go somewhere and have hot sex with him. She imagined herself touching his erect penis. She wanted to squeeze it so tightly that the flow of blood nearly stopped. Her other hand would gently massage his testicles. The hands now resting in her lap began to twitch. She opened and closed her fingers unconsciously. Her shoulders rose and fell with each breath. Slowly, She ran the tip of her tongue over her lips. But her stop was coming up soon. She had to get off at Jiugaoka. She had no idea how far the man would be going, unaware that he was the object of her sexual fantasies. He just kept sitting there, reading his book, obviously unconcerned about the kind of woman who was sitting across from him. When she left the train, Almama felt like ripping his damned paper back to shreds. But of course, she stopped herself. Almama was sound asleep in bed at 1 o'clock in the morning, having an intensely sexual dream. In the dream, her breasts were large and beautiful, like two grapefruits. Her nipples were hard and big. She was pressing them against the lower half of a man. Her clothes lay at her feet, where she had cast them off. Almama was sleeping with her legs spread. As she slept, Almama had no way of knowing that two moons were hanging in the sky, side by side. One of them was the big moon that had always hung there, and the other was a new, smallish moon. Tsubasa and the Dowager were also asleep in Tsubasa's room. Tsubasa wore new checked pajamas and slept curled into a tight little ball in bed. The Dowager, still wearing her street clothes, was stretched out in a long chair, a blanket over her knees. She had been planning to leave after Tsubasa fell asleep, but had fallen asleep there. Set back from the street in its hilltop location, the apartment house was hushed, its grounds silent, but for the occasional distant scream of an accelerating motorcycle or the siren of an ambulance. The German Shepherd also slept, curled up outside the front door. The curtains had been drawn across the window, but they glowed white in the light of a mercury vapor lamp. The clouds began to part, and from the rift, now and then two moons peeked through. The world's oceans were adjusting their tides. Tsubasa slept with her cheek pressed against the pillow, her mouth slightly open. Her breathing could not have been any quieter, and aside from the occasional tiny twitch of one shoulder, she barely moved. Her bangs hung over her eyes. Soon her mouth began to open wider, and from it emerged one after another a small troop of little people. Each one carefully scanned the room before emerging. Had the Dowager awakened at that point, she might have been able to see them, but she remained fast asleep. She would not be waking any time soon. The little people knew this. There were five of them altogether. When they first emerged, they were the size of Tsubasa's little finger, but once they were fully on the outside, they would give themselves a twist, as though unfolding a tool, and stretch themselves to their full 1 foot height. They all wore the same clothing without distinguishing features, and their facial features were equally undistinguished, making it impossible to tell them apart. They climbed down from the bed to the floor, and from under the bed, they pulled out an object about the size of a Chinese pork bun. Then they sat in a circle around the object and started feverishly working on it. It was white and highly elastic. They would stretch their arms out and, with practiced movements, pluck white, translucent threads out of the air, applying them to the fluffy white object, making it bigger and bigger. The threads appeared to have a suitably sticky quality. Before long, the little people themselves had grown to nearly 2 feet in height. They were able to change their height freely as needed. Several hours of concentrated work followed, during which time the little people said nothing at all. Their teamwork was tight and flawless. Tsubasa and the Dowager remained sound asleep the whole time, never moving a muscle. All the other women in the safe house enjoyed deeper sleeps than usual. Stretched out on the front lawn, perhaps dreaming, the German Shepherd let out a soft moan from the depths of its unconscious. Overhead, the two moons worked together to bathe the world in a strange light.
Chapter 20. Tengo. The poor Gilyax. Tengo couldn't sleep. Fukairi was in his bed, wearing his pajamas, sound asleep. Tengo had made simple preparations for sleeping on the couch, no great imposition since he often napped there, but he had felt not the slightest bit sleepy when he lay down, so he was writing his long novel at the kitchen table. The word processor was in the bedroom. He was using a ballpoint pen on a writing pad. This, too, was no great imposition. The word processor was undeniably more convenient for writing speed and for saving documents, but he loved the classic act of writing characters by hand on paper. Writing fiction at night was rather rare for Tengo. He enjoyed working when it was light outside and people were walking around. Sometimes, when he was writing at night, while everything was hushed and wrapped in darkness, the style he produced would be a little too heavy, and he would have to rewrite the whole passage in the light of day. Rather than go to that trouble, it was better to write in daylight from the outset. Writing at night, for the first time in ages, though, using a ballpoint pen and paper, Tengo found his mind working smoothly. His imagination stretched its limbs, and the story flowed freely. One idea would link naturally with the next, almost without interruption, the tip of the pen raising a persistent scrape against the white paper. Whenever his hand tired, he would set the pen down and move the fingers of his right hand in the air, like a pianist doing imaginary scales. The hands of the clock were nearing 1:30. He heard strangely few sounds from the outside, as though extraneous noises were being soaked up by the clouds covering the city's sky like a thick cotton layer. He picked up his pen again and was still arranging words on paper when suddenly he remembered. Tomorrow was the day his older girlfriend would be coming. She always showed up around 11 o'clock on Friday mornings. He would have to get rid of Fukairi before then. Thank goodness she wore no perfume or cologne. His girlfriend would be sure to notice right away if the bed had someone else's smell. Tengo knew how observant and jealous she could be. It was fine for her to have sex with her husband now and then, but she became seriously angry if Tengo went out with another woman. "Married sex is something else," she explained. "It's charged to a separate account." "A separate account? Under a whole different heading." "You mean you use a different part of your feelings?" "That's it. Even if I use the same body parts, I make a distinction in the feelings I use. So it really doesn't matter. I have the ability to do that as a mature woman. But you're not allowed to sleep with other girls and stuff." "I'm not doing that," Tengo said. "Even if you're not having sex with another girl, I would feel slighted just to think such a possibility exists." "Just to think such a possibility exists?" Tengo asked, amazed. "You don't understand a woman's feelings, do you? And you call yourself a novelist. This seems awfully unfair to me." "It may be unfair, but I'll make it up to you," she said. And she did. Tengo was satisfied with this relationship with his older girlfriend. She was no beauty, at least in the general sense. Her facial features were, if anything, rather unusual. Some might even find her ugly. But Tengo had liked her looks from the start, and as a sexual partner, she was beyond reproach. Her demands on him were few: to meet her once a week for 3 or 4 hours, to participate in attentive sex, twice if possible, and to keep away from other women. Basically, that was all she asked of him. Home and family were very important to her, and she had no intention of destroying them for Tengo. She simply did not have a satisfying sex life with her husband. Her interests and Tengo's were a perfect fit. Tengo had no particular desire for other women. What he wanted most of all was uninterrupted free time. If he could have sex on a regular basis, he had nothing more to ask of a woman. He did not welcome the unavoidable responsibility that came with dating a woman his own age, falling in love, and having a sexual relationship. The psychological stages through which one had to pass, the hints regarding various possibilities, the unavoidable collisions of expectations, Tengo hoped to get by without taking on such burdens. The concept of duty always made Tengo cringe. He had lived his life thus far skillfully avoiding any position that entailed responsibility, and to do so he was prepared to endure most forms of deprivation. In order to flee from responsibility, Tengo learned early on in life to make himself inconspicuous. He worked hard to negate his presence by publicly displaying very little of his true abilities, by keeping his opinions to himself, and by avoiding situations that put him at the center of attention. He had to survive on his own, without depending on others, from the time he was a child. But children have no real power, and so, whenever a strong wind began to blow, he would have to take shelter and grab onto something to prevent himself from being blown away. It was necessary for him to keep such contrivances in mind at all times, like the orphans in Dickens's novels. But while it could be said that things had gone well for Tengo so far, several tears had begun to appear in the fabric of his tranquil life since he first laid his hands on the manuscript of Fukaeri's Air Chrysalis. First of all, he had been dragged almost bodily into Komatsu's dangerous plan. Secondly, the beautiful girl who wrote the book had shaken his heart from a strange angle, and it seemed that the experience of rewriting Air Chrysalis had begun to change something inside of him. Now Tengo felt driven by a powerful urge to write his own novel. This, of course, was a change for the better. But it was also true that his neat, self-satisfied lifestyle was being tested. In any case, tomorrow was Friday. His girlfriend would be coming. He had to get rid of Fukaeri before then. Fukaeri woke up just after 2 o'clock in the morning. Dressed in his pajamas, she opened the bedroom door and came out to the kitchen. She drank a big glass of water, and, rubbing her eyes, sat down at the kitchen table across from Tengo. "Am I in your way?" Fukaeri asked in her usual style, free of question marks. "Not especially," Tengo said. "I don't mind." "What are you writing?" Tengo closed the pad and set his ballpoint pen down. "Nothing much," Tengo said. "Anyway, I was just thinking of quitting." "Mind if I stay up with you a while?" she asked. "Not at all. I'm going to have a little wine. Want some?" The girl shook her head. "I want to stay out here a while." "That's fine. I'm not sleepy either." Tengo's pajamas were too big on Fukaeri. She had the sleeves and cuffs rolled up. Whenever she leaned forward, the collar revealed glimpses of the swell of her breasts. The sight of Fukaeri wearing his pajamas made it strangely difficult for Tengo to breathe. He opened the refrigerator and poured the wine left in the bottom of a bottle into a glass. "Hungry?" Tengo asked. On their way back to his apartment earlier, they had had some spaghetti at a small restaurant near Koenji Station. The portions had not been very big, and several hours had elapsed in the meantime. "I can make you a sandwich or something else simple if you'd like." "I'm not hungry. I'd rather have you read me what you wrote." "You mean what I was writing just now?" "Uh-huh." Tengo picked up his pen and twirled it between his fingers. It looked ridiculously small in his big hand. "I make it a policy not to show people manuscripts until they're finished and revised. I don't want to jinx my writing." "Jinx?" "It's an English word. To cause bad luck. It's a kind of rule of mine." Fukaeri looked at Tengo for several moments. Then she drew the pajama collar closed. "So read me a book?" "You can get to sleep if someone reads you a book." "Uh-huh. I suppose Professor Ebisuno has read you lots of books."
"Because he stays up all night."
"Did he read you The Tale of the Heike?" Fukaeri shook her head.
"I listened to a tape."
"So that's how you memorized it. Must have been a very long tape." Fukaeri used two hands to suggest a pile of cassette tapes.
"Very long."
"What part did you recite at the press conference?"
"General Yoshitsune's flight from the capital."
"That's the part after the defeat of the Heike, where the victorious Genji General Yoshitsune flees from Kyoto with his brother Yoritomo in pursuit. The Genji have won the war against the Heike, but then the family starts fighting among themselves."
"Right.
What other sections can you recite from memory?"
"Tell me what you want to hear."
Tengo tried to recall some episodes from The Tale of the Heike. It was a long book with an endless number of stories. Off the top of his head, Tengo named The Battle of Dannoura. Fukairi took some 20 seconds to collect her thoughts in silence. Then she began to chant a decisive part of the final sea battle in the original verse.
The Genji warriors had boarded the Heika ships to find the sailors and helmsmen pierced by arrows or slashed by swords, their corpses lying in the bilge, leaving no one to steer. Aboard a small boat, new middle counselor Tomomori approached the imperial ship and said, "And so it seems to have come to this. Heave everything unsightly into the ocean." He ran from stem to stern, sweeping, scrubbing, gathering litter, cleaning everything with his own hands. The ladies-in-waiting asked, "How goes the battle, counselor?"
"Soon you will behold those marvelous men of the East," he replied with caustic laughter.
"How dare you jest at a time like this?" the women cried.
Observing this state of affairs, the nun of second rank proceeded to carry out the plan upon which she had settled long before. Hooding herself under two dark gray robes, she lifted high the hems of her glossy silk split skirt, tucked the imperial bead strand under one arm, thrust the imperial sword under her sash, and took the child emperor himself in her arms. "Mere woman though I am, I shall never fall into enemy hands. I shall go wherever His Majesty goes. All you women whose hearts are with him, follow us without delay." So saying, she strode to the gunwale. His Majesty had turned but 8 that year, yet he exhibited a maturity far beyond his age. His handsome countenance radiated an imperial glow, and his glossy black hair could cascade down his back past the waist. Confused by all the commotion, he asked, "Grandmother, where are you taking me?" She turned to the innocent young sovereign, and, fighting back her tears, she said, "Do you not know yet what is happening? For having followed the 10 precepts in your previous life, you were born to be a lord, commanding 10,000 charioteers. But now, dragged down by an evil karma, your good fortune has exhausted itself. Turn first now to the east, and say your farewell to the grand shrine of Ise. Then turn toward the west, and call upon Amida Buddha, that his heavenly hosts may guide you to the western pure land. This country is no better than a scattering of millet, a place where hearts know only sadness. I am taking you, therefore, to a wonderful pure land called Paradise." Her tears escaped as she spoke thus to him. His Majesty wore a robe of olive-tinged gray, and his hair was bound on either side in boyish loops. Tears streaming from his eyes, he joined his darling hands. First he bowed toward the east, and spoke his farewell to the grand shrine of Ise. Then he turned to the west, and once he had called upon Amida Buddha, the nun of second rank clasped him to her breast, and, comforting him with the words, "There is another capital beneath the waves," she plunged 10,000 fathoms beneath the sea. Listening to her recite the story with his eyes closed, Tengo felt as though he were hearing it the traditional way, chanted by a blind priest accompanying himself on the lute, and he was reminded anew that the tale of the Heika was a narrative poem handed down through an oral tradition. Fukairi's normal style of speaking was extremely flat, lacking almost all accent and intonation. But when she launched into the tale, her voice became startlingly strong, rich, and colorful, as if something had taken possession of her. The magnificent sea battle fought in 1185 on the swirling currents between Honshu and Kyushu came vividly to life. The Heika side was doomed to defeat, and Kiyomori's wife Tokiko, the nun of second rank, plunged into the waves holding her grandson, the child emperor Antoku, in her arms. Her ladies-in-waiting followed her in death rather than fall into the hands of the rough eastern warriors. Tomomori, concealing his grief, jokingly urged the ladies to kill themselves. "You'll have nothing but a living hell if you go on like this," he had told them. "You had best end your lives here and now." "Want me to go on?" Fukairi asked. No, that's fine, thank you, Tengo answered, stunned. He understood how those news reporters, at a loss for words, must have felt. How did you manage to memorize such a long passage?
Listening to the tape over and over.
Listening to the tape over and over, an ordinary person still wouldn't be able to memorize it. It suddenly dawned on Tengo that precisely to the degree she could not read a book, the girl's ability to memorize what she had heard might be extraordinarily well-developed, just as certain children with savant syndrome can absorb and remember huge amounts of visual information in a split second.
I want you to read me a book, Fukaeri said.
What kind of book would you like?
Do you have the book you were talking about with the professor? Fukaeri asked.
The one with Big Brother. 1984. I don't have that one.
What kind of story is it?
Tengo tried to recall the plot. I read it once a long time ago in the school library, so I don't remember the details too well. It was published in 1949, when 1984 seemed like a time far in the future.
That's this year.
Yes, by coincidence. At some point the future becomes reality, and then it quickly becomes the past. In his novel, George Orwell depicted the future as a dark society dominated by totalitarianism. People are rigidly controlled by a dictator named Big Brother. Information is restricted and history is constantly being rewritten. The protagonist works in a government office, and I'm pretty sure his job is to rewrite words. Whenever a new history is written, the old histories all have to be thrown out. In the process, words are remade, and the meaning of current words are changed. What with history being rewritten so often, nobody knows what is true anymore. They lose track of who is an enemy and who an ally. It's that kind of story.
They rewrite history.
Robbing people of their actual history is the same as robbing them of part of themselves. It's a crime.
Fukaeri thought about that for a moment.
Tengo went on. Our memory is made up of our individual memories and our collective memories. The two are intimately linked, and history is our collective memory. If our collective memory is taken from us, is rewritten, we lose the ability to sustain our true selves.
You rewrite stuff?
Tengo laughed and took a sip of wine. All I did was touch up your story for the sake of expedience. That's totally different from rewriting history.
But that Big Brother book is not here now, she asked.
Unfortunately, no, so I can't read it to you.
I don't mind another book.
Tengo went to his bookcase and scanned the spines of his books. He had read many books over the years, but he owned few. He tended to dislike filling his home with a lot of possessions. When he finished a book, unless it was something quite special, he would take it to a used bookstore. He bought only books he knew he was going to read right away, and he would read the ones he cared about very closely until they were ingrained in his mind. When he needed other books, he would borrow them from the neighborhood library. Choosing a book to read to Fukaeri took Tengo a long time. He was not used to reading aloud, and had almost no clue which might be best for that. After a good deal of indecision, he pulled out Anton Chekhov's Sakhalin Island, which he had just finished reading the week before. He had marked the more interesting spots with paper tags and figured this would make it easy to choose suitable passages to read. Tengo prefaced his reading with a brief explanation of the book, that Chekhov was only 30 years old when he traveled to Sakhalin Island in 1890, that no one really knew why the urbane Chekhov, who had been praised as one of the most promising young writers of the generation after Tolstoy and Dostoevsky, and who was living a cosmopolitan life in Moscow, would have made up his mind to go off to live on Sakhalin Island, which was like the end of the earth. Sakhalin had been developed primarily as a penal colony, and to most people it symbolized only bad luck and misery. Furthermore, the Trans-Siberian Railway had not yet been built, which meant that Chekhov had to make more than 2,500 miles of his trip in a horse-drawn cart across frozen earth. An act of self-denial that subjected the young man in poor health to merciless suffering. And finally, when he ended his 8-month-long journey to the Far East and published Sakhalin as the fruit of his labor, the work did little more than bewilder most readers. who found that it more closely resembled a dry investigative report or gazetteer than a work of literature. People whispered among themselves, why did Chekhov do such a wasteful, pointless thing at such an important stage in his literary career? One critic answered scathingly, it was just a publicity stunt. Another view was that Chekhov had gone there looking for a new subject because he had run out of things to write about. Tengo showed Fukaeri the location of Sakhalin on the map included in the book. Why did Chekhov go to Sakhalin? Fukaeri asked. You mean, why do I think he went?
Uh-huh.
Did you read the book?
I sure did. What did you think?
Chekhov himself might not have understood exactly why he went, Tengo said. Or maybe he didn't really have a reason. He just suddenly felt like going. Say he was looking at the shape of Sakhalin Island on a map, and the desire to go just bubbled up out of nowhere. I've had that kind of experience myself. I'm looking at a map, and I see some place that makes me think, I absolutely have to go to this place, no matter what. And most of the time, for some reason, the place is far away and hard to get to. I feel this overwhelming desire to know what kind of scenery the place has, or what people are doing there. It's like measles. You can't show other people exactly where the passion comes from. It's curiosity in the purest sense, an inexplicable inspiration. Of course, traveling from Moscow to Sakhalin in those days involved almost unimaginable hardships. So I suspect that wasn't Chekhov's only reason for going.
Name another one.
Well, Chekhov was both a novelist and a doctor. It could be that, as a scientist, he wanted to examine something like a diseased part of the vast Russian nation with his own eyes. Chekhov felt uncomfortable living as a literary star in the city. He was fed up with the atmosphere of the literary world and was put off by the affectations of other writers, who were mainly interested in tripping each other up. He was disgusted by the malicious critics of the day. His journey to Sakhalin might have been an act of pilgrimage designed to cleanse him of such literary impurities. Sakhalin Island overwhelmed him in many ways. I think it was precisely for this reason that Chekhov never wrote a single literary work based on his trip to Sakhalin. It was not the kind of half-baked experience that could be easily made into material for a novel. The diseased part of the country became, so to speak, a physical part of him, which may have been the very thing he was looking for.
Is the book interesting? Fukaeri asked.
I found it very interesting. It's full of dry figures and statistics, and, as I said earlier, not much in the way of literary color. The scientist side of Chekhov is on full display. But that is the very quality of the book that makes me feel I can sense the purity of the decision reached by Anton Chekhov, the individual. Mixed in with the dry records are some very impressive examples of observation of character and scenic description. Which is not to say there is anything wrong with the dry passages that relate only facts. Some of them are quite marvelous. For example, the sections on the Gilyaks.
The Gilyaks, Fukaeri said.
The Gilyaks were the indigenous people of Sakhalin long before the Russians arrived to colonize it. They originally lived at the southern end of the island, but they moved up to the center when they were displaced by the Ainu, who moved north from Hokkaido. Of course, the Ainu themselves had also been pushed northward by the Japanese. Chekhov struggled to observe at close hand and to record as accurately as possible the rapidly disappearing Gilyak culture. Tengo opened to a passage on the Gilyaks. At some points he would introduce suitable omissions and changes to the text in order to make it easily understandable to his listener. The Gilyak is of strong, thick-set build and average, even small, in height. Tall stature would hamper him in the taiga. That's a Russian forest, Tengo added. His bones are thick and are distinctive for the powerful development of all the appendages and protuberances to which the muscles are attached, and this leads one to assume firm, powerful muscles and a constant strenuous battle with nature. His body is lean and wiry, without a layer of fat. You do not come across obese, plump Gilyaks. Obviously, all the fat is expended in warmth, of which the body of a Sakhalin inhabitant needs to produce such a great deal in order to compensate for the loss engendered by the low temperature and the excessive dampness of the air. It's clear why the Gilyak consume such a lot of fat in his food. He eats rich seal, salmon, sturgeon, and whale fat, meat and blood, all in large quantities, in a raw, dry, often frozen state. And because he eats coarse, unrefined food, the places to which his masticatory muscles are attached are singularly well-developed, and his teeth are heavily worn. His diet is made up exclusively of animal products, and rarely, only when he happens to have his dinner at home, or if he eats out at a celebration, will he add Manchurian garlic or berries. According to Nevelsky's testimony, the Gilyaks consider working the soil a great sin. Anybody who begins to dig the earth or who plants anything will infallibly die. But bread, which they were acquainted with by the Russians, they eat with pleasure, as a delicacy, and it is not a rarity these days in Alexandrov or Rykova to meet a Gilyak carrying a round loaf under his arm. Tengo stopped reading at that point for a short breather. Fukaeri was listening intently, but he could not read any reaction from her expression. "What do you think? Do you want me to keep reading, or do you want to switch to another book?" he asked. "I want to know more about the Gilyaks." "Okay, I'll keep going." "Is it okay if I get in bed?" Fukaeri asked. "Sure," Tengo said. They moved into the bedroom. Fukaeri crawled into bed, and Tengo brought a chair next to the bed and sat in it. He continued with his reading. "The Gilyaks never wash, so that even ethnographers find it difficult to put a name to the real color of their faces. They do not wash their linen, and their fur clothing looks as if it had just been stripped off a dead dog. The Gilyaks themselves give off a heavy acid smell, and you know you are near their dwellings from the repulsive, sometimes hardly bearable odor of dried fish and rotting fish offal. By each yurt usually lies a drying ground filled to the brim with split fish, which, from a distance, especially when the sun is shining on them, look like filaments of coral. Around these drying grounds, Kruzenstern saw a vast number of maggots covering the ground to the depth of an inch. Kruzenstern. I think he was an early explorer. Chekhov was a very studious person. He had read every book ever written about Sakhalin. Let's keep going. In winter, the yurts are full of acrid smoke which comes from the open fireplace, and on top of all this, the Gilyaks, their wives, and even the children, smoke tobacco. Nothing is known about the morbidity and mortality of the Gilyaks, but one must form the conclusion that these unhealthy hygienic arrangements must inevitably have a bad effect on their health. Possibly it is to this they owe their small stature, the puffiness of their faces, and a certain sluggishness and laziness of movement. "The poor Gilyaks," Fukaeri said. Writers give varying accounts of the Gilyaks' character, but all agree on one thing, that they are not a warlike race, they do not like quarrels or fights, and they get along peacefully with their neighbors. They have always treated the arrival of new people with suspicion, with apprehension about their future, but have met them every time amiably, without the slightest protest, and the worst thing they would do would be to tell lies at people's arrival, painting Sakhalin in gloomy colors and thinking by doing so to frighten foreigners away from the island. They embraced Kruzenstern's traveling companions, and when Schrenk fell ill, this news quickly spread among the Gilyaks and aroused genuine sorrow. They tell lies only when trading or talking to a suspicious and, in their opinion, dangerous person. But before telling a lie, they exchange glances with each other in an utterly childlike manner. Every sort of lie and bragging in the sphere of everyday life, and not in the line of business, is repugnant to them. "The wonderful Gilyaks," Fukaeri said. "The Gilyaks conscientiously fulfill commissions they have undertaken, and there has not yet been a single case of a Gilyak abandoning mail halfway or embezzling other people's belongings. They are perky, intelligent, cheerful, and feel no standoffishness or uneasiness whatever in the company of the rich and powerful. They do not recognize that anybody has power over them, and it seems they do not possess even the concept of senior and junior. People say and write that the Gilyaks do not respect family seniority either. A father does not think he is superior to his son, and a son does not look up to his father, but lives just as he wishes. An elderly mother has no greater power in a yurt than an adolescent girl. Bosniak writes that he chanced more than once